Thank you all for coming. This is the second panel in what we're calling Reason Day here at Freedom Fest. My name is Anthony Randazzo. I'm the Director of Economic Research for the Reason Foundation. We're going to talk about elements of Dodd-Frank and problems in regulatory climate for financial services. On our panel today will be myself and also the esteemed Gene Epstein, who is the economics editor at Barron's. I will just keep this short and turn this right over to Gene. We'll try and leave lots of conversation for our Q&A. Thanks, Gene.
Well, first, thanks to Anthony and the Reason people for inviting a Barron's reporter to speak at a Reason event. My little talk is called The Dodd-Frank Follies. I think I'm going to be taking the high road and take the opportunity to be what I was urging Charles Murray to be yesterday and urge others at Freedom Fest to be every once in a while in the spirit of Milton Friedman. Try to keep those radical ideas lying around because you never know when you might need them. You know, if I was here sitting in front of you in 1987 or 1988 and told you the Berlin Wall is going to fall in 12 months, the Soviet Union is going to unravel in a couple of years, you would have told me to go see my shrink for my delusions of grandiosity. Those things do happen. And so let's keep those radical ideas around. Let's understand what Dodd-Frank is all about briefly, however. The Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, as it's called. The first question we might ask is, why no mention of Fannie and Freddie and Dodd-Frank? None at all. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the two large elephants in the room, who are currently being indicted by the SEC. Fannie and Freddie, the joke is they're not being indicted by the SEC. They've been given a legal pass because if the SEC collected from Fannie and Freddie, the taxpayer would have to pay up. So it's only the six executives who've been indicted by Fannie and Freddie. Now, well, we have an explanation from the New York Times, from Joe Nocera, columnist of the New York Times, and Bethany McLean in their best-selling book, All the Devils Are Here. Bethany writes for Vanity Fair. She brings the social democratic message to the upper classes. This is their explanation. The reason that the legislation makes no mention of the GSEs is that nobody can figure out what to do. Can we ever have a truly private sector market for mortgage securitization, or will it always require government? Can Fannie and Freddie's roles eventually grow smaller as the financial system regains its confidence? Can they be privatized, abolished, turned into government agencies? None of these answers satisfy. In the spring, the Treasury Department requested public input on the re-engineering of the mortgage system and the reform of the GSEs. In response, Treasury got more than 570 comment letters. There is no consensus. Well, I guess if the Ag Department had asked, should we do away with subsidies to rich farmers, they'd get about 570 comment letters, many from senators from ag states and their minions and other rich farmers, and there will be no consensus. Nobody knows what to do. That's the message of the New York Times' final word, so to speak, in this definitive book, All the Devils Are Here. Well, I'm going to skip over Judge Posner on Fannie and Freddie because actually I'm beginning to anticipate that I'm going to run out of time. He wrote a book called The Failure of Capitalism. My talk on what really happened, as you may recall, those of you who attended my talk yesterday, is that it was really a failure of capitalism and that the good judge doesn't know the difference between capitalism and capitalism. He doesn't understand profit and loss. One hopes that he'll learn that somewhere before the next book he writes, which will probably be tomorrow morning in his case. Well, what's the obvious explanation for, what's the no-brainer on why the legislation doesn't make any mention of Fannie and Freddie? Well, because it's named after Dodd and Frank. It was authored by Chris Dodd, who received refi mortgages in 2003 from Countrywide Financial, which did expensive business with Fannie and Freddie. The Select Committee on Ethics said that Dodd should have questioned why he had been put in the Friends of Angelo VIP program at Countrywide. Angelo Mozzillo was head of Countrywide, and Countrywide eventually was purchased because it was putting out a lot of bad loans. It was clearly a minion of Fannie and Freddie, and Chris Dodd was clearly benefiting. He was a friend of Angelo. Of course, it never occurred to Chris Dodd that this was anything unusual, because I guess it was business as usual. But the embarrassment did apparently drive Chris Dodd from the Senate. He's now, I gather, head of the motion picture industry of America, where presumably he can do less harm. Barney Frank, my God, he and other House Democrats sent a letter to President George W. Bush in June 2004 saying the proposed crackdown would weaken affordable housing performance by emphasizing only safety and soundness. You know, the two enemies, you know, safety and soundness. This, of course, had dogged Barney Frank, but the guy is a very nimble politician. Congratulations on his marriage a week ago, as you may have read. That's sort of nice about him. He's a politician who's willing to be made a good husband by his newfound husband. But apart from that, he is someone that you might even want to indict for what happened, just based on this statement. You know, when you indict someone with respect to financial fraud, you have to prove intent. You have to prove knowledge. You know, that's how they got Bernie Madoff. Clearly, Bernie understood what he was doing. Now, did Barney? I think he did. In 2003, he said about the guarantee of Fannie and Freddie debt. But there is no guarantee. There is no explicit guarantee. There is no implicit guarantee. There is no wink and nod guarantee. No guarantee of Fannie and Freddie debt. Now, one would think that anyone could understand that that clearly the market disagreed with him. The market disagreed with him because the market, by the way, many of them foreign investors, some of them central banks, and I think that's one of the reasons why Fannie and Freddie were bailed out so quickly, were buying Fannie and Freddie debt at interest rates not far above the Treasury rate. Fannie and Freddie got preferential treatment in the credit markets. So they certainly thought there was a guarantee, certainly an implicit guarantee, certainly a wink and nod guarantee. Barney Frank either should not have been dealing in finance on the Hill, or he was clearly intending to defraud the taxpayer. On that basis, maybe an indictment could be brought against Barney Frank for the fraud, because everyone was right, the market was right. Fannie and Freddie, as you know, went into what is called conservatorship in the summer of 2008. The bill, according to the Congressional Budget Office, is going to be more than $300 billion to bail out Fannie and Freddie. Well, we can then say, obviously, that the reason why the bill does not mention Fannie and Freddie is because it's named after two of their puppets, Dodd and Frank. I don't even have to go further about the Dodd-Frank bill. The political economy of the Dodd-Frank bill is that the government, and perhaps no government, can recognize that this was not a sin of omission on the part of the regulator. This was a sin of commission. This was an explicit attempt on the part of three presidents, really, to some degree, starting with George H.W. Bush, who signed initial legislation pushing the government into getting Fannie and Freddie and HUD and others into high-risk mortgages, starting in the 90s, continued with Bill Clinton, it continued with George W. Bush. So Barney Frank and Chris Dodd were two big guns who were pushing it as well. So there's no question that Dodd-Frank is going to do what it does, which is not at all address the problems that created the meltdown. But I want to deal briefly with the poster boy of Dodd-Frank, who's Paul Volcker. Obama was shown embracing Paul Volcker when the bill was signed into law. Paul Volcker on the Volcker Rule. We've been reading a lot about that, about the losses of Jamie Dimon, and we're supposed to think that the Volcker Rule matters. Look, if a bank is going to lose a lot of money, then let them eat their losses. This is a profit and loss system. There are lots of losses that go through this system. That's what disciplines the system. Losses encourage prudence. Losses are important to a capitalist system, but that had to do with discretionary trading. Volcker doesn't like discretionary trading. It was his pet project. But in an interview, at least, Mr. Volcker was quick to point out that proprietary trading was not the cause of the 2000 crisis. It was the origination of many, many bad home loans to people who could not repay them. Well, if Volcker knows that, then the rest of us should. Whatever we might or might not think of proprietary trading, it actually is a kind of impossible thing to enforce, despite Diamond's losses. Let Diamond eat those losses. Let him learn from those losses. That's what the capitalist system is all about. It's really not the kind of bill anybody would support, but more important to our point, it has nothing to do with what Dodd-Frank was supposed to be about. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was created by Dodd-Frank, and that's perhaps one of the most important outcomes of the legislation. And I just wanted to quote a recent bulletin from the CFPB. A lot can be said about the harm that they're doing, but it just as an indication of the fact that this is really, again, the fox guarding the chicken coop, that the CFPB, to the extent that it's going to have any power over mortgages, is just basically going to be an arm of Barney Frank and Chris Dodd, and the spirit of Barney Frank and Chris Dodd, is a recent bulletin from them. And I'd like to quote things with relative full, because I want to make it clear that I'm not giving you ellipsis and suppressing what was really said. In response to recent inquiries, the CFPB issues this bulletin to provide guidance about compliance with the fair lending requirements of the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, which makes it illegal for a creditor to discriminate in any credit transaction against any applicant because of race, color, religion, national origin, sex, marital status, age, if the applicant is old enough, receipt of income from any public assistance program, or the exercise in good faith of a right under the Consumer Credit Protection Act. Well, this continues the same unfortunate myth that bankers, who are presumably in the business of making money by issuing mortgages, discriminate against black people. This opens the door completely to the same kind of myth, the same kind of practice that financial institutions began to hear from Janet Reno in the 90s, that they're going to be indicted. And there were cases against banks for supposedly discriminating against black people. Well, here's some data which indicates that really the CFPB really ought to be defending us whites against those Asian Americans and Native Hawaiians. It shows the percentage of applicants turned down for conventional mortgage according to a Fed and Civil Rights Commission study in 2000. Interestingly, by the way, if you look at the flip side, it actually shows that a majority of African Americans, a majority of whites, and a majority of Asian Americans and Native Americans were actually approved for mortgages. So that in itself is kind of funny, but it demonstrates obviously that whites are discriminated, that African Americans are discriminated against in favor of whites, but those Asian Americans and Native Hawaiians are the true one percenters of mortgages, because they get mortgages much more readily than whites do. Well, clearly, this is all nonsense. It's clear enough that even in 2000, there was a tendency on the part of financial institutions to try to look at all of the various measures of credit, the FICO score, not just the income, a whole lot of obvious things in order to evaluate credit quality. But if CFPB is going to resurrect the whole idea that this in itself, by the way, would be evidence in terms of what they stated, that whites have a case against Asian Americans and Native Americans, and that African Americans have a case against both of them, it would be the same kind of absurdity. But that's what the Dodd-Frank created commission is going to produce. Well, I'm going to cut to the chase. I probably don't have too very many more minutes. Let's try for the radical solution, which could be lying around just in case we need it, just in case some kind of prudence arises on Capitol Hill. Bring back the banker we love to hate, the SOB and starch collar who wouldn't give you the mortgage because your credit wasn't good. Get rid of the banker we love to despise, the crapshooter who gives everyone mortgages regardless of race or marital status. He does that because he's under the umbrella of Fannie, Freddie, and the Fed, because everybody had the impression that Alan Greenspan and then Bernanke would provide for us all. There was absolutely no knowledge on the part of even the Federal Reserve as late as 2007 that a mortgage debacle was brewing. If the Fed, given all its access to data, didn't know, how can you expect anybody else to know? So the crapshooters, the worst got on top. As often happens in any situation, the crap shooters who can go for the fast buck start running our financial institutions rather than the prudent starch bankers we love to hate. So how do we bring them back? I'm going to skip Judge Posner again. Well, the Obama administration points the way. The advantages of relying on private finance to reform the housing finance market was actually, in a February 2011, Reforming America's Housing Finance Market report to Congress, issued by who, I don't know who wrote it in the Obama administration, but it did mention that private actors will not be as inclined to take on excessive risk without the assurance of a government guarantee behind them. No longer would taxpayers be at direct risk for guarantees covering most of the nation's mortgages. Well, you guys really said a mouthful. Congratulations to the Obama administration. They haven't acted on it, but what do we need to do? Well, we need to phase out all government involvement in housing finance. We need to abolish HUD, jokingly called by some the Department of Housing and Urban Destruction. Abolish Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. For further details, read two men who've really informed me, three men in particular, really informed me a lot, Ed Pinto, Peter Wallison, and Alex Pollack. Ed Pinto, by the way, really has given me a lot of data. He was chief credit officer of Fannie Mae in the late 1980s, and he's a real source of great information. How to take a government out of housing finance. Second, radical proposal, you know, which wouldn't even be necessary in this particular case, because all you really need to avoid a housing bubble is just to get the government out. But you need to abolish deposit insurance in any case. Deposit insurance was opposed by one president. Deposit insurance, he predicted in October 1932, would lead to laxity in bank management and carelessness on the part of both banker and depositor. That was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, probably the most sensible thing by far that FDR, at least that was ever attributed to FDR. He reluctantly signed the Glass-Steagall bill that put deposit insurance into law. At the time, they had postal savings accounts. What's happened with the deposit insurance is the insurance limit was raised from $40,000 to $100,000 in 1980. It's now effectively $50 million because of CDARS. It's now effectively unlimited. If you have $50 million, your bank can swap it out and create a protection at the expense of the taxpayer. I try to tell a few social democratic friends, doesn't it bother you? Need to wrap. Doesn't it bother you that people with $50 million accounts are being protected by the taxpayer? Well, we can replace FDIC insurance with treasury bills for people of limited means, similar to postal savings accounts, private insurance policies for the better off, and then, more importantly, those of you who care can probably check websites, which will arise, can probably check a whole lot of wonderful watchdog groups that will arise, which will tell you, don't put your money into that bank. It's not managed well. Put your money to the other bank. That will discipline bankers. Put capitalism in place, a system of profit and loss that encourages risk-taking and that also encourages prudence. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Gene. A lot of intellectual firepower there, a lot of ideas that we can discuss. I want to build a little bit on this idea of basically rejecting the status quo nature of what Dodd-Frank did. Essentially what Dodd-Frank purported to do was to try and solve the problems of the financial crisis. And in fact, it just built into a lot of the problems that were in place in the first place. It gave the Federal Reserve more power and authority. It created even more regulatory bodies, the CFPB and the all famous now FSOC, the Financial Stability Oversight Council or committee, which is essentially in charge of finding financial institutions and saying you are too big to fail and you are too big to fail. They're literally putting labels on these institutions as systemically important financial institutions that are identifying them as you can go out and you essentially do whatever you want and we will be there to bail you out. They say that they have a resolution system in place. Whether or not that is even capable of working, sort of, well, I guess we'll have to see once we have the next financial crisis. We also gave, instead of letting large financial institutions that had grown too big to be able to manage themselves and did make a lot of mistakes based a lot on government regulatory incentives, but made a lot of mistakes themselves and had a lot of ignorance, instead of allowing creative destruction to take hold, those institutions have just become bigger. And so now we have institutions that are even larger than before. And we even took the capital requirements system through Basel, and we've kept that in place. And we just expanded it, and we kept the risk weighting nature of Basel in place for banks to continue to misallocate capital. So the response of Dodd-Frank and everything surrounding it just built into the problems, and that's going to come back into the next crisis. I would take a very pessimistic tone and say that it's not a matter of, well, if we act now, we can stop the next crisis. There will be another crisis. We may go through 2, 3, 4 more crises before it's possible for us to wake up to the fact that you can't regulate something like this away, that actually letting real capitalism and not crony capitalism operate is the only possible way that we're going to have sort of stable economic growth going forward. And what the challenge of those of us at Freedom Fest, those of you who favor liberty for organizations there, and for what I see at Reason is to try and identify as we go along how the regulatory regime is continuing to create problems. So when Peregrine Financial collapses, and just as a quick backstory on this, so this is a futures trading organization. It was recently discovered that they had a $200 million fraud on the books. The law says that if you're a customer and you give them money, that they have to keep that money in a separate pile from any money they invest by themselves. That's essentially a 100% reserve, as opposed to when you put money in a bank, because they have the FDIC, they don't have to keep all of that money in the bank. They can go and they can lend it. But if you're with organizations like Peregrine, they actually had to hold all of it. That's what they told their customers they would do. They broke that. They broke that that law. They took 215 or so million of that, and it's just gone. It's missing. And it was because they were investing on their own behalf, and they either lost it or they spent it in some capacity. Now, there is a role for regulation. One of the things that I constantly have to, when I'm speaking in the media or with someone from a more progressive perspective, sort of push back on, is we don't want a completely unregulated market. What is the role for government to provide justice? But regulation doesn't have to come from the government. It does this just because you want to monitor organizations doesn't mean that this has to be a government body that does this. You could have a third party accrediting body monitor organizations like Peregrine that customers are paying, such organizations through such competition, and there would be competition as to who these third party groups would be, to provide some kind of check to make sure that they're just not defrauding. Now, they can make bad bets. No one's going to stop someone from making a bad bet, but you have to protect property rights. So when we're talking about peeling back layers of regulation, what we're talking about is getting the government out of trying to protect the consumers, saying that there are better ways to be monitoring and protecting consumers because the government is incapable of doing it. The CFTC is incapable of monitoring this. And for Peregrine, the CFTC, which is the overall regulator for such an organization, they went and they looked at this group last January, specifically looking for fraud. So MF Global failed last year, a similar organization. They had a similar defrauding of their customers. And so the CFTC said, oh, we need to look at a bunch of organizations. They went and they looked at this organization, Peregrine, because they had had four other major fraud violations in the past decade. So they went and they looked at their books and they said, okay, you're good. Well, this has been a 2-year-long fraud. They completely missed it. They are completely more or less incompetent to take a look at this. We could run down a very long list of failures of the SEC. There's just it is impossible to track every rule that is in place. The rules are too complex. The skill set is not there. And to continue to depend on government set regulators is not sort of a path for future growth. So we need alternative ideas. Then that doesn't mean that as lovers of liberty, we just have to rail against the idea of regulation. What it means is we need to look at what are the best ways to be actually monitoring to protect property rights. You don't have to have police stationed at your door to protect your own property. You can have a neighborhood watch. And a lot of people will complain that, well, you can't have self-regulatory bodies. because the industry will just be focused on themselves. Well, it's all depending on how you set up a self-regulatory body. If a self-regulation body is like a industry association where the incentives are aligned, like Peregrine, which had its own CEO on a self-regulatory organization within the futures industry, they was all made up of people in the industry. Their incentives were to protect their own, their incentives were to protect institutions. Their incentives were not to protect their customers. So if you're gonna set up a self-regulatory organization, it has to have the properly aligned incentives. So when we're thinking about problems of Dodd-Frank and we're trying to point things out that are in the market, I think that there are ways that we can highlight that this is not the right response. We're just building into more problems. There are solutions, and it doesn't have to be a chaotic anarchist system. Hopefully arguments like that are something that can maybe we can just sort of keep around to when eventually, and maybe it's optimistic to say there'll be 5 crises from now, maybe it'll be 50 crises from now, that we can sort of keep around to when there might be some moment of waking up to push us more towards measures of liberty in the financial sector.